too, which I often do often do with what I'm just turning on the recorder for. I wrote my first book, Machinery of Freedom, about 40 years ago. It's still in print in a second edition. It and quite a lot of other things can also be found on my webpage for free. The web is a so-so technology for selling information, but a wonderful technology for giving it away. So if people are curious, you can find the bulk of my articles and all of my books that I could persuade the publishers to give me permission to web are readable for free from my webpage. That includes Law's Order, it includes Future Imperfect, it includes Machinery of Freedom, it includes one novel, and a variety of other things. Machinery of Freedom is still in print, second edition. I've been thinking about doing a third edition, and in thinking about that and in thinking about various other things, have in various ways tried to expand and deepen and improve the ideas in that book. And so what I wanted to do in this talk was first to sketch out the system of institutions that I suggested in that book for how you could have a society in which the most fundamental functions of government were handled privately, in which you carried the sort of free market position all the way to its outer limit of replacing everything, and then go on to discuss what I think I've learned since then. And I should say, this owes a fair amount to the review by Jim Buchanan that was just quoted from, because that review was the only good review the book got, and my definition of a good review is a review that makes the author think. And Jim pointed out a hole in the line of argument I was proposing there, and I spent some time trying to figure out how you fill that hole and what are the implications of doing so. So that's part of what I'll be talking about. But let me start by sketching the basic model that I imagined when I wrote that book, in which I was saying if the free market works better for producing food and producing automobiles and producing books, maybe it could also work better for producing laws and law enforcement. And how could you imagine institutions in which that happened? And the basic model I imagined is a society where there are private firms that sell the service of protecting your rights and settling disputes you have with people. And essentially everybody chooses to be a customer of one such firm. And then there is a problem which occurs to everybody who you discuss this to, and they explain why your system can't possibly work. And the problem is that I come home to find that my television set is missing. And I check the automatic camera that my rights enforcement agency installed in my living room in case somebody stole something, and they find a photograph of Professor Dalton walking out the front door with my television. And so my rights enforcement agency gets in touch with him, and they say, please return Professor Friedman's television set, and you owe us $50 for our time and trouble locating you and getting it back. And his reply is, what television set? I've got a nice television set. It's true. A friend of mine sold it to me a year or so ago. Never heard anything about Professor Friedman. Didn't he teach at BTI a long time? Anyway, another story. So my rights enforcement agency says, well, if you're not willing to discuss the matter and to somehow provide evidence of having bought the television set, tomorrow morning, three big tough guys are going to show up at your door to go through the door in any way necessary and take our customer's television set back to him. And Professor Dalton says, well, that's very interesting, but you have to realize I, too, have a rights protection agency. And my rights enforcement agency, when I call them up and say that three thugs are going to come and try to steal my television set, they'll send five big tough guys to protect me. And now people say, aha, system breaks down, turns into chaos, warfare, violence, and so forth. And this is the answer that Ayn Rand gave at some point and that many, many other people have given. But it's the wrong answer. And it's the wrong answer because these agencies are profit-making firms and violence is expensive. And it ought to be clear to them that there is a better solution. So in the story as I've described it, my agency gets in touch with his agency and they say, look, we've got a problem. If we end up with our employees fighting your employees, somebody might get hurt, your customer's house might get trashed in the process. This is not the way to satisfy our customers. How about We go to a private arbitrator, a private firm in the business of settling disputes that both of us know is honest and competent. And we agree that if the arbitrator says that it's Professor Friedman's television set, that you agree you will not defend Professor Dalton when we come to take the television set away. And if it says that it's Professor Dalton's television set, we will pay you some modest indemnity for the trouble we have put to you by falsely accusing your customer of robbery. They agree, problem settled. Now, of course, it's not really going to be improvised this way, because these two agencies know that over a period of years, this story is going to happen over and over again, because there are going to be legal disputes between customers of one agency and the other. And so the obvious long-term solution is that the two agencies agree in advance that all such disputes will go to the private court that both of them trust, and that both of them will abide by the verdicts. And now the immediate question that ought to occur to you is, well, it's all very nice that they made this agreement, but what enforces that agreement? Because this is a world in which there is no government. There is no court system above the agencies. And the answer is that what enforces that agreement is what we sometimes refer to as the discipline of constant dealings. The fact that these are repeat players, and each agency knows that if when the decision goes against their customer, they refuse to abide by it, then next time when it goes the other way, the other agency won't abide by it. They're back stuck fighting each other. That's going to result in their doing a bad job of protecting their customers, having to pay hazard pay to their employees, and pretty soon both of them will lose all their customers to other agencies that have a more reasonable and responsible and sensible policy and settle all of their disputes peacefully via arbitration rather than violently, by violence. So that's the guts of the institutions that I'm imagining. And the next question is, where does the law come from? All right, what are these legal rules that are being enforced? And the answer is, it is being produced on the market. And it's being produced by the private courts, because each private court has some set of rules which determine how it settles cases. And when a rights enforcement agency contracts with the court, it is in effect buying for its customers that set of legal rules, because now disputes its customers get into will be settled under those rules. This is a polylegal system in the sense that the legal rules between me and you may not be the same as the legal rules between the two of them, or even the legal rules between me and somebody else, because each pair of agencies is contracting on a court. There is going to be some market pressure towards uniformity, just because it's convenient to people if the rules are similar across the different agencies. But there doesn't have to be uniformity. And so there may be some agencies which specialize in customers who want detailed water law, because their customers live in arid areas where it's really important to know who has the right to draw water from a river. And there may be others that specialize in customers who don't want that because it's just a nuisance because they live in areas where water is free. And there'll be lots of other variations. So then the question is, what kind of law are you going to get? What can you say about the legal rules produced by this system? And the argument I offered in the book, which I'm going to qualify a little bit later on, is that this system will tend to produce what economists refer to as efficient legal rules, where by efficient legal rules, we mean rules that maximize the summed benefit to the parties they affect. And let me walk you through how this happens. We will imagine that my agency and your agency are discussing whether or not to go to a court that believes in capital punishment. And my agency finds that its customers like capital punishments. Its customers are quite confident they will never be convicted of killing anybody, and they want to make sure that anybody who kills them ends up going to the electric chair, because that way they think people will be deterred from killing them. Your agency, on the other hand, finds that its customers have the opposite opinion, that they're a little bit worried that they might be convicted, correctly or incorrectly, of killing somebody, and they don't really believe the death penalty deters anyway, and they think it's sort of morally objectionable to kill people. So the customers of one agency want the death penalty, the customer of the other agency doesn't. How do you settle this? Well, my agency does some market research. They explore the tastes of their customers in order to answer the question, if we could guarantee them that disputes with that agency over there went to a pro-death penalty court, how much more would they be willing to pay for our services? And they conclude that getting a pro-death penalty court is worth $1 million a year to their customers. Your agency does similar research with theirs, and they conclude that getting an anti-death penalty court is worth $2 million a year to their customers. So the two agencies agree on an anti-death penalty court, and your agency either makes a side payment to my agency of something between $1 million and $2 million, or concedes on some other disputed issue to do what my agency wants. And that seems to me a fairly simple, rough sketch of how in this system law will be generated. And the economists in the audience will hopefully see that this means that, roughly speaking, and again, I'm going to have to qualify this in a few minutes, but roughly speaking, that you tend to get those legal rules that maximize the benefits to those concerned. Because if my customers value the rule more than yours do, they get their rule, vice versa the other way. So that was the basic logic of the system as I described it when I wrote Machinery, say, about 40 years ago. I now want to discuss things that were missing from that argument, some of which alter it and some of which don't. And I think they fit into at least three categories for the moment. Only three categories that are the market for law. There's a fourth category that I may get into, which has to do with what is or isn't the government anyway. But we'll see about that. And the three categories, one of them is market failure on the market for law. All right. Market failure is an economist's term. And like a lot of technical terms, it's misleading. All right. I like to give an equivalent to all the people out there who think that they understand the theory of relativity, except for the mathematical details. Right? The theory of relativity says everything's relative. I understand that. But, of course, that's not what the theory of relativity says. Similarly, market failure is not a description of all forms of failure, and it is not about markets. All right? Market failure is a situation, one way in which failure occurs, and it occurs in many contexts other than markets as well as markets. What's market failure? Market failure is a situation in which individual rationality doesn't lead to group rationality. So my standard example, one of my several standard examples, was observed by me when I was teaching at UCLA. Because just south of UCLA, there is what the locals claim to be the busiest highway intersection in the world. Or at least claimed it when I was there a long time ago. Like 8 lanes or 10 lanes each way. And every day you see the same pattern. The lights on Wilshire are about to change. And the drivers on Wilshire keep trying to cross. And the result is that when the light goes red, Wilshire is packed solidly with cars. And the people coming the other way, I think it's Westwood, I think, I'm not sure, whatever the other street are, can't get through. And gradually those cars drain out just in time for the people going the other way to fill up the intersection when their light turns red. Think about that situation. No driver is making a mistake. All right? Each driver would be even worse off if he politely waited to go into the intersection until he was sure he'd get across. But all of the drivers would be better off if all of them behaved that way. All right? So that's a nice, simple example of market failure. It's a case where because my action imposes costs on you, which I ignore, and your action imposes costs on me, which I ignore, each of us acting to maximize his own welfare produces a result which is worse for all of us than if we had acted differently. All right? That's one example. I've got lots of other examples, but that one will do for the moment. All right. I want to talk about market failure on the market for law. All right. Imagine we've got my system. What will go wrong? Where won't it generate efficient law? And the answer is that it won't generate efficient law in any case where the legal rule between me and you affects him. All right. And the simplest example for this is intellectual property. Suppose the question is, should the court our agencies agree to hold that he can't copy my books without my permission? Should it enforce copyright law? I I'm not going to discuss here the very difficult question of whether copyright law is a good idea or whether patent law is a good idea. It's an interesting question. I don't really know the answer for sure. But my point now is, suppose it's true that copyright law is a good idea. Let's look at the costs and benefits and who pays and who receives. If the agencies agree to go to a court that recognizes copyright law, then when Professor Dalton wants copies of my books, he's going to have to pay me royalties to get them. That's just a transfer. He loses the money, I gain some money. That's no net gain either. Second, there are going to be a couple of costs. One of them is the cost of enforcing that rule, making sure he isn't pirating the book. And another is the fact that some people will choose not to read a book, or not to buy a book, or not to copy a book, because the royalty is higher than the value to them. Why is that a net cost? Because it costs me nothing at all for you to copy my book. So as long as there is any value to you to having a copy, the net effect on both of us is higher if you copy it. But as long as I charge a price because I want some money for my books above zero, there will be some people for whom the book is worth more than zero but less than the royalty who don't get a copy. That's a deadweight loss. That's what economists refer to as the deadweight loss of intellectual property. So that's a cost. What's the benefit that might balance it? The benefit that might balance that is I have an incentive to write books. All right, you can't copy a book that isn't written. And copyright law means that I get some money by writing books. Therefore, it might be the case, for all I know, it is the case, that we're better off in a world with copyright law, which gives people an incentive to write books, even though there are the costs that I've described to it. But now, think about the bargain between my agency and his agency. Only a small fraction of the people who will read my books are customers of either agency. So if he agrees to pay me royalties, that results in my producing more books, and most of the benefit of my producing more books goes to people who are not in the bargain. Goes to the customers of other agencies. All right? So that means that our agencies may choose not to create copyright law, even though it's worth creating. Right? Even if the net benefit is larger than the net cost, since all of the costs go to their customers, and only some of the benefits go to their customers, it might turn out that they don't have copyright law when they should. So that's a case where you get an inefficient outcome coming out of the market for law. Due to the standard source of inefficiencies on other markets, what economists call externalities, the fact that our decision affects other people who aren't part of the market. So that's one thing I realized after I wrote the book that was a respect in which I'd overstated my case, that my market has a tendency to produce efficient laws, just as the market for producing steel has a tendency to produce steel only when it's worth more to the people who use it than it costs to produce. But the market for producing steel also produces air pollution, which doesn't get counted in the calculation, and some of my legal rules also produce costs or benefits for third parties, which get left out of the calculation. And I should say, it may have occurred to some of you, that while the example I gave was intellectual property law, I could have given the example of pollution law. Because if our agencies agree that you can sue me when my smokestack puts out stuff that makes you cough, your being able to sue me means I put out less of that stuff. That stuff will also influence people who aren't customers of our two agencies, and therefore the incentive to have strong legal rules against pollution will be inefficiently weak. All right? So, I'm not a utopian. I am not claiming and have never claimed that the institutions I'm arguing for are perfect, merely that they're better than any alternative that I know. Because if you think not about my system for making law, but about the way we presently make law, it's hard to see that there's any substantial incentive to make efficient legal rules. That if you think about how a democratic government works, or any other government, but think about democratic ones, because those are the ones we're most familiar with, what incentive does the government have to do the right things? And there's what I think of as the civics class model of democracy. And the civics class model of democracy say your representatives have to do good things because otherwise you'll vote them out. And the trouble with that model is that in order to vote them out, you have to know they're not doing good things. Think about your incentives as a voter. If you spend a lot of time and effort following what your congressman is doing, which means both finding out how he voted in each vote in Congress, and more difficult, figuring out for each of the things he voted about whether it was good or bad. Even then, you don't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy. Because it might be that you went to him and you said, look, you voted for that bill, that's a bad bill. He said, you're right, it's a bad bill. But I had to vote for that to get some other congressmen to vote for this good bill of mine, which is much more important. He might be telling the truth. You don't know. My point is that actually monitoring your representatives in the way you would have to do in order for the civics class model of democracy to work would take a lot of effort by you. It would be costly. What benefit do you get for that effort? Essentially zero. Because you know that in a large population polity, and even Idaho is a large population polity, let alone the United States, the chance that your vote will change the outcome is very, very close to zero. I figure for a presidential election, it's probably about 1 in 5 million. People talk about how close the Florida vote was in a recent presidential election. Yes, indeed. If you had cast 10,000 votes, you could have changed the outcome. But you don't cast 10,000 votes. So as far as I know, and I may be wrong, I do not know of any election at the national level in which I include Congress and congressmen as well as presidents that has ever been decided in the U.S. by one vote, or by 10 votes, or by 50 votes even. There have been close elections, but not that close. So you as a rational person will say, if I spend this time and effort figuring out what my congressman is doing and whether I approve of him, I will get no benefit for doing so. There are many other ways I could spend my time and money, some of which do provide a benefit. For example, I could spend my effort deciding what car to buy. When I do that, if I decide that one car is better than another, sure enough, that's the one I get. So in the ordinary market context, your decision determines what happens to you, and you therefore, as a rational individual, have an incentive to be well informed. In the political marketplace, your decision has essentially no effect on what happens to you, and therefore you as a rational individual have an incentive not to be well informed. It's not worth the cost. This is what economists who teach what's called public choice theory refer to as rational ignorance. It is rational to be ignorant when information costs more than it's worth. Given rational ignorance, the whole civics class model breaks down. All politicians say they are good guys. What you actually know is whether he's handsome or whether he has a nice voice or whether he does a good job of, I don't know what the appropriate term is, but throwing the ball more or less of giving speeches that sound pleasant. But you don't actually know whether he's doing the right things or the wrong things. I could go into more detail if this were a talk on public choice theory. My basic point is that when I concede that my market for law will do an imperfect job of producing efficient law, I don't regard that as a reason to reject it, because the alternative, which is law produced through political mechanisms, it seems to me will do a very much more imperfect job. The surprise of anything is that we've survived at all, that it has not done a bad enough job to result in all of us starving to death. But it nonetheless does a bad job in lots of ways. I could go into details. As you probably know, the U.S. has the highest incarceration rate of any developed country in the world. The reason it does so is that it is politically popular for bad reasons to have laws against the use of certain recreational drugs. As far as I can tell, there are no good arguments for that position, at least that I've managed to discover in the last 40 years, and it imposes immense human costs, direct or indirect. You could think of a lot of other examples. That's just one that happens to strike me. So to put it differently, I would have said that not just in my case, but in general, that in terms of ordinary private markets, market failure is the exception, and in terms of political markets, market failure is the rule. Because in most political, what causes market failure? The fact that I am making a decision where I don't bear the costs and benefits. Almost all political decisions have that characteristic. That when you vote, if you vote for the right guy, most of the benefits goes to other people. If you vote for the wrong guy, most of the costs do. When you lobby for something that will benefit your industry, the costs go to other people, your customers probably. and so forth. So the fact that market failure exists on private markets, it's a real fact about them. It means they will not run as well as if a perfectly wise, benevolent philosopher king were running the world, but we have a striking shortage of perfectly wise, benevolent philosopher kings. And it seems to me that in general, markets do better than the alternative. In any case, but as I say, it doesn't do perfectly, and it doesn't do perfectly in predictable ways. I'm predicting that if they ever set up my system, you will have a less than optimal level of intellectual property protection and a less than optimal level of anti-pollution law. Whether better or worse than the state, I can't tell you. The state might have less than optimal, more than optimal, don't know. All right. Second point has to do, second point is really aimed more at the economists in the audience than anybody else. And that has to do with thinking about what this market for law really is. And I like to think of it as the market for legal assent. Because what's happening is that you are getting people to agree on the legal rules between them. And as the institutions would actually exist, the individuals aren't doing that. As the rules would exist, the rights enforcement agencies are picking courts which make the rules, but the individuals are picking rights enforcement agencies. So, in effect, the individuals are indirectly, through middlemen, choosing what rules apply to them. And let me do one way that economics textbooks sometimes start out with Robinson Crusoe. They say, imagine that instead of having the elaborate system of middlemen and corporations and unions and everything else, imagine just a few people doing things. My price theory textbook, for example, and my book Hidden Order, which is the price theory textbook rewritten to be read for fun instead of because people make you read it. I should say, as an interesting lesson in the application of economics, there's a reason Hidden Order is a better book than price theory. And it's not just because I wrote it second. The reason is because when I was rewriting Hidden Order, at some point I realized that if at any point in this book the reader decides he's not interested, I'm losing him. No one is making him read it, unlike a textbook. So if you want to know why textbooks are as bad as they are, think about the incentives of authors. All right? So, in any case, so I should say that when I wrote Hidden Order, what I ended up doing was trying to start every chapter with a hook. Trying to start every chapter with some question, puzzle, set of ideas, such that the reader would want to get to the end of the chapter to find out the answer. That was the tactic I used. And it's been my most successful book, I should say, by a fair margin. And it's not up on the web because I couldn't get my publisher to let me do it. First, I think I've got a sample, maybe the first chapter or something is on the web. So that one you actually have to buy if you want to read it. But that's fine. I don't mind you buying my books. I don't mind you not buying my books either. I write them mostly to get them read and only secondarily as a source of income. All right, so let me go on to look at the market for legal assent. And at first glance, it looks like a perfectly competitive market because here there are all these millions of people agreeing. But then if you're an economist, you say, wait a minute. On a competitive market, if I was thinking of buying a bushel of wheat for you and a bushel of wheat from him, and you decide not to sell me any, I buy two bushels from him. But if I want to buy your agreement to legal rules, to a set of legal rules with me and his agreement, I don't get to buy two agreements from one guy and none from the other. All right? So it's not really a competitive market in which people are producing things that are substitutes for each other. What it really is, if you sort of work out the arithmetic, is about 2 to the 17th bilateral monopolies. All right? No, 10 to the 17th, I'm sorry. 10 to the 17th bilateral. We've got a population of 300 million people. For the mathematically inclined, that's 3 times 10 to the 8th. Every pair of people represent a bilateral monopoly in agreeing on the legal rules between them. So you square that number, and you have a very, very, very large number of bilateral monopolies. And therefore, the standard economic analysis of perfect competition isn't going to work. And you have to think rather in terms of the analysis of bargaining and bilateral monopoly. Bilateral monopoly for the non-economists means one buyer and one seller. And in what I am describing, that's the case, but it's the case for every pair of people. Only you can agree through middlemen to rules with me. Only I can agree with you. But even in bilateral monopoly, rational people... people are going to tend to bargain to efficient outcomes, because if I value the rule more than you do, then I'll be willing to make you an offer you'll be willing to accept. So again, for the economists in the audience, the argument for efficiency here owes more to Coase than to Marshall. Alfred Marshall is the man who put together modern economics a little over 100 years ago. Coase is a much more recent author, and Coase made the point that where there are inefficient arrangements, in principle it's always in the interest of the parties to bargain them away, because that means there's some gain to make from that. At a slight digression, going back to market failure for a moment, I like to say that another name for market failure is a profit opportunity. Because market failure means that people are acting in a way such that if they acted differently, they'd all be better off. So if you're sufficiently ingenious to think up a way of getting them to act differently, with any luck you can pocket some noticeable fraction of the amount better off they are, and then you make yourself rich and you make the world a better place all at the same time. This reminds me, by the way, of one of my favorite quotes. There was a Texas oil millionaire, whose name I'm now blocking on, but it'll come to me in a minute, who was a right-winger, and he had a chain of radio stations. And the radio stations, among other things, put on programs arguing for his political views. And he was interviewed by Playboy magazine. And Playboy magazine, the interviewer, took it for granted that he was subsidizing these radio stations to spread his views. And he said, oh, no, they make money. If this country is worth saving, it's worth saving at a profit. So I always thought it was a wonderful line. Anyway, so the nature of the market then is not a standard economist competitive market, but it is a market which has got a dynamic that ought to drive you towards efficiency, because the parties who are doing this bargaining via their middlemen care. And again, for the economists in the audience, if you go back to my analysis of the two agencies bargaining, I hope some of you realized that it's not a perfectly efficient process, because the agencies only care about marginal customers. That if I'm somebody who really likes the agency, the fact they make it like it even more isn't going to give them anything, because what determines the price they can charge is the price at which the people who aren't sure they like it would leave. All right. In the same sense, Apple Computer could raise the price of their computers by 10%, I'd still buy them. What constrains Apple are the people who are foolish enough to switch to Windows, if only the Apple gets a little more expensive. All right? So again, this is probably enough. If there are economists in the audience, they can think through for themselves the logic of the system. I just wanted to point out that it was, in fact, a more complicated and interesting system than I had originally thought. Let me now go on to the third section of my argument, and this is where Jim Buchanan comes in. Because Jim pointed out in his review that when I described the two agencies bargaining, I never said which one had to pay the other. All right? So imagine our agencies are bargaining over capital punishment. And the agencies both agree that it is worth more to the anti-capital punishment agency than the pro-capital. Does that mean that the anti-capital punishment agency has to pay the pro to agree? Or does it mean that all it has to do is to turn down the offer that the pro made it to agree the other way? Or putting it differently, is the default, is the starting point they are bargaining from, a legal rule with or without capital punishment? So that was Jim's original point, and he was right, that I hadn't thought about the question. For economists, this is really the old division between allocation and distribution. That the allocation is getting efficient rules. The distribution is figuring out which set of customers have to pay for them. All right? It's just like imagining an ordinary free market society and saying, we've proved it'll give efficient outcomes, but according to whom we assume starts out owning stuff, we might get very different efficient outcomes. If you imagine a society with slavery, which starts out with some people owning other people, legally speaking, standard economic arguments go through, you get an efficient outcome, but it's not a very good efficient outcome for the slaves. You would get a different but still efficient outcome in the economic sense if you didn't have slavery. All right? Similarly, for who owns the land, for all sorts of other issues. Well, in this case, in a certain sense, Jim is asking, who owns the right to have what legal rules? Where do we start? And I thought that was a very interesting question, and one that got me thinking. And I guess my answer was that underlying this bargaining game, there's an implicit threat game. That underlying the bargaining game, there is the knowledge by everybody that if we don't reach agreement, we start shooting each other. And that therefore, somehow, where we end up reaching agreement reflects where we think we would end up if we had to fight. Right? And in fact, thinking about that, I suspect that all societies have an implicit threat game underlying their bargaining games. That if you think about things like the Occupy Wall Street movement, one way of reading that movement is people saying, we are not willing to play by the rules. We're not willing to accept your legal rules. We think we're getting too bad a deal, and we are therefore going to use force, very modest kind of force, just sort of going places we're not allowed to go. They don't have any guns as far as I know. But nonetheless, we are willing to break the rules in order to try to insist on getting what we want. And if you think about something like the current chaos in Syria, that's a much more extreme version of the same thing. So I think it's, people talk about a social contract. And the idea of a social contract is normally said it doesn't make a lot of sense. If people say, you know, why are you obliged to obey the law? Well, you agreed to. When did I agree to that? Well, you stayed in the country. Well, but in order for my staying in the country to agreement, the government has to already own the country. It's got to already have the right to say, if you don't agree to our rules, you have to leave. But they're supposed to own the country because of the social contract. So the argument becomes entirely circular. But I think there is a different sense in which it makes sense to think of an imaginary social contract. But it's not really a contract. It's a peace treaty. That is to say, you have a society. I know perfectly well that I can't get everything I think I'm entitled to. Because we disagree. You know you can't get everything you think you're entitled to. We also know that if we start shooting each other, someone's going to get hurt. And so people end up saying, well, this is how much of what I think I'm entitled to I'm willing to put up with getting, and how much with not getting, so are you. And within some range, none of us are going to start using violence to upset the society as long as that happens. Now, I don't think that solves the question of why are you obliged to obey laws, but then I don't think you are obliged to obey laws. So that's not a problem for me. I think you're obliged not to do wicked things. You're obliged to obey the law against murder, but you would still be obliged if there were no law against murder. But I think you're not in general. I don't think that right and wrong are made by act of Congress. Why? Because peace treaties are not morally binding. There is this rule in the law that a contract made under duress is not a legitimate contract. And it's hard to think about more duress than dropping bombs on people, which is what usually precedes peace treaties. Anyway... So much on sort of general views on how societies work. But let me go back to the more interesting question to me of what are the implications of this analysis for the working of my system? Because one of the questions I haven't yet mentioned, but that I discuss in the book, is the question of whether my system is unstable due to agencies getting together, deciding that robbery is more profitable than production, and reinventing government. All right. You could certainly imagine in my system that the rights enforcement agencies, they're talking to each other all the time, they're negotiating agreements. How about negotiating an agreement which says none of our customers are allowed to quit? I won't take your customers, you won't take my customers, and by the way, we're raising our rates. All right, they've just reinvented government. They've created a cartel from the economists in the room. Which cartel, in effect, is the government? Question is, how likely is that to happen? Now, there are a number of things that might prevent that. If you imagine a society where lots of people have guns and are willing to use them, then the right of revolt might prevent that. But I suspect that at a more realistic level, the real question is how many agencies there are. Because if you think about cartels in general, in an industry with two or three firms, cartels are likely to be practical. In an industry with 100 firms, cartels don't work, because as soon as a few firms get together and start raising their prices, everybody else says, wonderful, prices are high, let's produce all we can. And that drives prices back down again. Similarly here, I think that it would be very hard to make that cartel work if you end up with 100 or 1,000 rights enforcement agencies. Because when a few firms start getting together, that gives other firms an incentive to say, we'll be delighted to take your customers, all of them, thank you, and we will defend your customers from you. But if you end up with two agencies or three agencies, you might well be in trouble, because then it becomes practical for them to convert my anarchist system back into a government with them running it. And that might even be worse than our present government. Who knows? When I wrote Machinery, I was thinking of the size of firms in terms of the economics of enforcing rights. All right? I said, is there a reason to believe that a big rights enforcement agency with lots of customers could produce better service at a lower cost than a small one with few? And I said, I don't think so. That if you look at least at the government equivalent, we don't observe that big city police departments manage to prevent crime better, cheaper than small town police departments. I can't see much evidence. It's hard to be sure, but it's a service industry. Most service industries don't have huge economies of scale. So my guess at the time was that it would be 100, not 3. That's fine. But I've now complicated the analysis by observing that the agencies are really producing two different products. One of the products is rights enforcement. The other is threatening other agencies in order to get a good deal. Well, in many circumstances, if you think of international history, in many circumstances there are quite large economies of scale to the use of violence. Not always true. All right, there have been times when big countries couldn't beat small countries. And, of course, small countries can ally with each other. So it depends partly on the technology of several small agencies getting together and agreeing, if the big agency tries to bully us, we'll all work together. But there was at least the concern that it might turn out that even if economies of scale were not very large in protecting rights, that economies of scale were quite large in threatening other agencies in order to make sure that they paid you when they wanted a rule rather than you're paying them when you wanted one, in which case my system could break down, in which case you could end up with too small a firm. So that's, from my standpoint, the intellectually interesting part of this story, which is that Jim pointed out a problem which had, on the face of it, nothing to do with economies or scale. It was just that there was a step in my argument I'd missed. I filled it in. When I fill it in, I discover that it indeed, to some degree, undercuts a different and apparently unrelated part of the argument about economies or scale. How serious is this? I don't know. My guess is that if the system is once established and working, it's not going to be much of a problem. Because I think if you look again at the international situation, you observe that there is an enormous inertia to the equilibrium of these threat games. We don't observe that every time a country launches another battleship, its border moves 3 miles out. You don't observe that if a country cuts its military budget, its border moves 5 miles in. So it looks, in this case, and I think a lot of others, as though this kind of a threat bargaining game, once you've got a status quo, you tend to stick with the status quo. That in the world I'm describing, once everybody knows what the rules are, now if my company tries to change them in its favor and says, and I'll fight you if you don't, everybody else will say, that's crazy. What do you want us to do? To be killing each other? Don't be absurd. We will all oppose you and it won't work. So my guess is that once established, it's not too serious a problem. And you're back to the case where 98% of what the firms are producing is rights enforcement and only 2% is the tanks in the basement, just in case. I mean the kind of tanks that go bang bang, not the kind of tanks you put oil in. And if I'm right, then hopefully we get reasonably small firms, a competitive situation, and it works. But I could be wrong. I certainly don't want to claim in any sense that I know for certain how this system will work, only that I think I can make a plausible case for the claim that it would work better than the kind of systems that we now have. All right, there are some other things that will be in the third edition when and if I write it. I have some problems associated with copyright law due to the fact that my publisher of the second edition controls the copyright unless they let the second edition go out of print. I haven't yet gotten them to agree to do a third edition or to return the copyright to me, and it is quite unclear whether or not they let the second edition go out of print, because our concepts of out of print existed before print-on-demand publishing existed. And the question is, if they say, as they did for several years, if you want a copy of this book, tell us, and in 2 months we'll print one for you. Is that in print or not? Don't know. So In the worst case, what I will do is to write all the additional stuff for the third edition and put it up on my web page. And I've already got the second edition up on my web page because I did talk my publisher into doing that. I should say the copy of the second edition, a PDF on my web page, is a pirate copy. I discovered online that somebody had pirated the book, that somebody had scanned it in and put up a PDF of the book. And I told my publisher. And they did something and it disappeared. And after a while it appeared again. And I said to myself, they aren't hiring me to be their enforcement arm. If they want to prevent people from pirating the book, let them pay attention. But I did download a copy for myself. I then eventually persuaded my publishers, since they weren't selling very many copies of an old book, to give me permission to put a PDF up on my webpage, and guess where I got a PDF to put up on my webpage. So I have pirated my pirate, which seemed to me entirely appropriate. Anyway, so let me say a little bit about the other stuff that will be in that third edition when and if I write it. And one of them is an expansion of something that's already in the book. And that is really the question of, have I really proposed an anarchy without government or a different kind of government? Are these rights enforcement agencies really governments? And that turns out to be quite an interesting question, because it gets you thinking about why do we call some things governments and not other things. I don't think there is anything that a government does that is not at some time and place been done by things that aren't governments. All right? For example, we tend to think of warfare as a government activity. As best I can tell, the Norse armies that ravaged Anglo-Saxon England were mostly entrepreneurial projects. They weren't national armies. You had some leader with a good reputation, and he got a whole bunch of Vikings to come and said, look, we can get loot, we might even get some land, let's go visit England. And I think the same thing is true through a wide variety of other government activities. So why do we call some things governments and some not? And the answer I came up with in Machinery of Freedom, which I think was the right answer, except I think I understand it better now than I did then, is that government is what I referred to as an agency of legitimized coercion. And I tried to explain that I was using both words in special senses, because I didn't know of any words that really said what I meant. Because I wasn't using coercion as a moral category. What I meant by coercion was the sort of act which, if other people did it to you, you would violently object to. You might be right or wrong. All right, I'm not a moral philosopher. As I've said somewhere else, I prefer not to base my arguments on moral philosophy, because moral philosophy is a project that hasn't gotten very far in the last few thousand years. I prefer to base it on economics, to basically argue most people have about the same objectives of what they would like a world to be like, not in detail, but roughly. If I can persuade you that the institutions I want will better achieve your objectives, I don't have to make arguments on what objectives you ought to have. That's been my tactic for 40 years or so. So in any case, but we know that people do regard things as coercion. That when someone steals stuff from you, you yell, you run after him, you hit him in the head, you do what you can, and you do that even if you know that the value of what's been stolen is not large enough to make it worth all this effort to respond. All right? We observe that human beings have what I think of as built-in commitment strategies, which basically say if you cross certain lines, I will bear large costs, not infinite costs, but large costs to punish you for doing it. And I think I've got an article on my webpage and link to my blog called A Positive Account of Property Rights. It's not really about property rights. It's got that title because it was written for a conference on property rights. It's really about rights. And the argument I'm making is that you can think of rights not as either a moral or a legal category, but as a behavioral category. That essentially, in all societies, people have lines they've drawn in their heads. And most of them recognize the lines other people have drawn in their heads, saying, you cross this line, and I'm willing to bear large costs to stop you. All right? And that's what that article is about. And I'm arguing that's the real nature of rights as a behavioral pattern. And then what I mean when I say a government is an agency of legitimized coercion is that you don't respond that way when the government violates your rights. that governments, the way I put it, I think, in the machinery, is that when the IRS tells you that they have frozen your bank account, you don't go down, yell, you're running down the street yelling, "Stop thief." All right. You don't do the equivalent of that. When you receive a notice in the mail saying that you're due for jury duty, even though you never agreed to be at a certain time and effort, you don't react the way you would be if somebody came up to you, pointed a gun at you, and said, "You're now working for me on the following terms, like it or not." Which is, after all, what jury duty is. It's the one draft that we still have, having eliminated, fortunately, the military draft. So, turns out it's easy to get out of, I should say. It's not a very effective draft. But in theory, at least, that's what it is. So, I think it makes sense to think of a government in those terms, that what's special about government is that for whatever reasons, it is an organization that does the things that when done by ordinary individuals, we would forcibly react against, and we don't forcibly react against it. Now, legitimized isn't a very good term, because one reason might be you think it's legitimate. It might be you say, yes, government's entitled to do those things. Another reason you might be where you say, well, look, they got an awful lot more guns than I do. It isn't worth trying to fight them. I've surrendered, not conceded that they're right. So there could be a variety of reasons why we don't respond to government violations of our rights the way we respond to ordinary violations. But I think the fact that we don't comes as close as I can to defining government. And if so, my agencies are not governments. My agencies claim no rights that an ordinary individual doesn't have. They may actually violate rights in a moral sense. It may be that their court's wrong and that their court says you can be punished for something you shouldn't be punished for. But that's just like the fact that a private individual might think he's entitled to do something that, if we only had moral philosophy worked out right, we would know he wasn't entitled to do. It's not anything special about the agencies. So that's one of the things which I think I saw intuitively when I wrote the book, but I see a good deal more clearly now, and as I say, I've got an article you can read which goes into it in detail. The other thing, which isn't really about the market for law, which was what I think I offered as a title for this, but maybe I didn't, at least I'm assuming I did, is what I referred to as the hard problem when I wrote Machinery, which is national defense. All right. The sort of traditionally, for people who were very pro-free market, the three fundamental government functions were police, courts, and national defense. I've just eliminated two of them. And the question is, what about the third? And the third is actually a much harder problem, because national defense is what economists call a public good. And again, just as with market failure, public good doesn't mean a good produced by the public. The government produces lots and lots of private goods, mail delivery, schooling, for example, and many public goods are privately produced. For example, this speech. Why do I think it's a public good? Because I would like to believe that I will change the minds of some people in the audience, give them interesting ideas, and the result will be a better society 50 years from now. I may be wrong. Maybe I'm optimistic about this. But if I'm right, then I am producing a benefit that I can't pocket. All right? A public good is a good such that the producer can't control who gets it. Well, in principle, the people who set up this talk could control which of you came into the room. So in that sense, it's not clear it's a public good. But there's no way of controlling which people 50 years from now benefit from the fact that because all of you are now enlightened, you go out and you vote against governments doing things and support private rights enforcement agencies and do all sorts of wonderful things like that, with the result that in 50 years we have a much better society. No way that I can charge the people living in that society for the benefit I'm producing. So I'm producing a public good. I think I'm producing a public good. And there are lots of other, I could give other examples of public goods privately produced. But public goods are harder to produce privately than private goods, because the standard mechanism on the market for producing a good is to say, all right, if it's worth something to you, pay me if you want to get it. And then if what the good is worth to people is more than it costs me to produce it, I can make money producing it. So the basic logic of why a market economy tends to do the right things is that if something is worth more than it costs, you can make money doing it. If it's worth less, you'll lose money, so you won't do it. All right? That doesn't work for public goods. National defense is a public good. If I defend the border against the invaders from Canada, that will benefit you people. You're closer in California to them than I am, since I live in California. So if you defend the border against the invaders from Canada, I will free ride on your virtuous and patriotic efforts. All right. So that's a public good problem, and the question is, how would you pay for that? And as with other public goods, the answer is there are a variety of kludges, a variety of imperfect ways you might do it. And my current view, which may well be wrong, but which interests me, sort of combines a bunch of different things and ideas. One of them is the open source movement in software, which involves a lot of people cooperating for benefits in sort of status and reputation outside of a normal market economy of money. Another thing is the observation of a lot of people like playing at soldiers for fun. The version of that I know best is the Society for Creative Anachronism. I used to participate in battles with 1,000 people or so on a side using swords and shields. The swords were not made of steel, fortunately. We use real armor and fake weapons so you don't get really killed. But it was lots of fun. And a much larger number of people engage in paintball along similar lines. And then the last element in this is a short story by Rudyard Kipling, who is somebody I'm very fond of. And the story is called The Army of a Dream. And in the story, Kipling has come back to England. You don't know where he's been. And it's changed. And he's talking with a young military officer who's a friend of his, who is explaining how things are now. And how things are now is that war games have replaced football and cricket as the national sport. And war games, you're not really using live ammunition and killing people, but you're maneuvering people around with referees who will say, if this was a real battle, you would have won, or you would have won. And the result is that in this imaginary England, you have, in effect, an enormous potential army without depending on actually hiring soldiers. And therefore, everybody else is careful not to attack England. That's the bottom line. And at the very end of the story, Kipling notices that the friend he's talking to has a bullet hole in the middle of his forehead and remembers that he died in the Boer War and realizes this was all a dream and wakes up. But it's quite a neat story. So in my the one other thing that inspires it is the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Or more precisely, what I believe to have been the motivation for the Second Amendment. That's the Right to Bear Arms Amendment. Because I think that in the 18th century, people were faced with a problem. And the problem was that it was pretty clear that man-for-man professional soldiers beat amateur soldiers. It was also pretty clear that a professional army was a very dangerous thing to have. Because in the previous century, the commander of the best professional army in England, a man by the name of Oliver Cromwell, first won the first civil war on behalf of Parliament, the side he was fighting for, and then won the second civil war on behalf of himself and the New Model Army, and made himself military dictator of England. And I think people were aware of that history, and they saw that as a dangerous thing. And the solution they came up with was to have a small professional army and an enormous militia. Have a system in which essentially every adult man is armed, has a little minimal training, in which the professional soldiers sort of coordinate things and make sure that the people can work together. And if anybody invades us, we will have a small professional army, but an enormous second-rate amateur army. And if a professional army decides to take over, they're outnumbered 100-1 by the amateurs. And I think, though I'm not sure, that that's the theory behind the Second Amendment. So my version of that in my anarchy is that you have lots and lots of people who train as soldiers for the fun of it, and maybe for status and for things of that sort. And then you have a small professional army supported by charity, which is one of the ways we produce public goods in the real world. And that professional army in peacetime, which is going to be almost all of the time, helps arrange contests among amateur units, make sure they standardize their communication protocols, that they use the same kind of ammunition, does all the coordination you need in order that 10 million amateurs could actually, if they had to, fight a war. And if there is a war, they're essentially the top-level officer corps coordinating this large group of amateurs. I've got a list of short stories that I'm not going to write there on my webpage. And one of the ones which actually isn't on my webpage is the one which involves Apple Computer Company. And in this one, there are some people, militiamen, some people who are members of one of these volunteer companies. And they're discussing why it is that when the Soviets, or whoever it is at this point, attacked us, their missiles all blew up and were on takeoff. And the other guy says, well, I'm not sure. But do you remember the marksmanship contest last year where the people from Apple won in spite of the fact they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn because they hacked into the scoring computers? I think they did it again. So I like to imagine that sort of on April 15th, which of course is going to be our Independence Day, that you have parades and various companies which subsidize their own little military groups for the publicity, have their people marching with their banner, with the corporate banner, flying on it, and people then buy their products and they say, look, these are good public-spirited people, they're helping to defend us. I don't know if it would work. As I hope you realize, I'm not really in the prophecy business. But I think you could imagine that sort of cobbled together defense working as long as we don't have really dangerous enemies. And I'm not sure if you've noticed, but we don't have really dangerous enemies anymore. All right. When I wrote Machinery of Freedom, the Soviet Union was a going concern, and they had a whole lot of missiles with hydrogen bombs on them. Back in when we did the first Iraq War, I did a calculation for my own interest. I added up the GNP of the two sides in that war, and the ratio was 100 to 1. That is not a war. All right? The Al-Qaeda may be a nuisance. They may kill a few people. But they aren't an enemy in the sense in which Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union were. So in that sense, we are now... I talked about an invasion from Canada. Well, Mexico is the other threat. All right? We don't need a very strong military to protect ourselves from either Mexico or Canada, I don't think. All right? So as long as we are in an environment where we aren't facing really powerful, aggressive enemies, it seems to me quite likely that this kind of society could do a sufficient half-assed job of producing national defense to defend us. In a less favorable environment, maybe not. If you believe you can't defend yourself, well, you don't abolish that part of government. Once you believe you can, you do. That sort of is my view of the national defense question. All right. I concluded a long time ago that the great advantage of a question period is that when you're answering a question, you can be pretty sure that at least one person in the audience is interested in what you're talking about. So I think I've, for the moment, gotten to the end. Maybe I'll come and talk some more things if you raise sufficiently interesting questions. So let me turn it over to you. Thank you. Anybody? Nobody?
Yes.
Think about a microphone here. Microphone is a device intended to distort the human voice.
So in your system with these agencies, do your rights match those of your socioeconomic status? Is it about how much you can pay? Is what you can protect? And so if so, what about those on the lower end of the socioeconomic class?
Back when I wrote Machinery, I did a calculation of how much government spending actually went to rights enforcement. That is basically police and courts. And it turned out to be a tiny amount. That's not one of the major government expenditures. Maybe $200 per capita per person, that kind of number. Remember that in my world, you aren't paying sales taxes. You aren't paying property taxes directly or indirectly in the rent of your building. So I think the practical answer is that almost everybody is going to be able to afford the cost of hiring a rights enforcement agency for a price considerably less than they was previously paying in taxes. There might be people whom that isn't true. If it's a reasonably decent society, somebody will raise the money to provide at least a minimal kind of rights protection payment for them. But I think that as a practical matter, what I'm talking about is not going to be very expensive. And note that in general, what determines the quality you get is not what you can afford, but what you're willing to pay. That if you look at the way the economy actually works, firms don't spend most of their resources building stuff for millionaires. There aren't enough millionaires. Most of what's produced in the market is for the mass audience. And similarly, it's going to be hard to run a rights enforcement agency if only one person in 1,000 in the area is your customer. So you're much more likely to be providing the level of protection and the level of the terms negotiated that lots of people in your area regard as desirable. Now, I should also say, I'm not sure if you've noticed, but if you're poor in America, you're quite likely not to have your rights protected. Quite aside from the ones that are violated by the government, large parts, if you look at crime rates, the inner city is not a really great place to live. Not everybody poor lives in the inner city, so it really depends on lots of things. But the idea that government sort of treat everybody equally is a myth, and it's been a myth in all times, I think, it's a myth for our society. Even where it's true in theory, it is not true, in fact, in practice. And again, all I got to do is do better than the present system in order for my system to be desirable. I don't have to do perfectly, and I'm not going to. Other?
I have a question. Regarding the agencies and cartels, what stops an existing cartel, say 3 or 4 large agencies, from effectively preventing new business? Because obviously the easiest way is for them to lose business is for new business to be created. But what stops them in a world with no third-party law enforcement from just bullying a new guy out? And as an example, I would use De Beers Diamonds, that's effectively crushing African governments who didn't agree to sell diamonds to them.
I'm dubious that that happened. The question of De Beers is actually an interesting economic question, because it's at least arguable. I've seen it argued, whether correctly I don't know, that De Beers got its position because there were large economies of scale in marketing diamonds. And if you're curious, I can describe the argument at some point, probably after the talk, and I'm not sure it's right. But in this case, if large agencies operate at a larger cost than smaller agencies, there are going to be an awful lot of potential smaller agencies that they're going to have to deal with. That I think in general, the idea that you can create what's sometimes referred to as an artificial monopoly, a monopoly by driving other companies out of business, is mostly mythical. As you may know, there's this classic article, The Myth of Predatory Pricing, written a long time ago in the Journal of Law and Economics, which essentially pointed out that Standard Oil, which was sort of a standard example, if you actually read through the Standard Oil, the lawsuit that eventually resulted in Standard Oil being broken up, there was not a single example of predatory pricing in that history. And there's a reason. Not whether it applies to this case or not, it may well be that competition with threats of violence maybe is different. But at least if you look in ordinary markets, the problem is that if I'm producing 90% of the oil and you're producing 1% of the oil, it's true I'm much richer than you are. But if I start selling below cost to drive you out, I'm also losing money 90 times as fast as you are. And in fact, I'm losing money more than 90 times as fast, because when I cut prices, demand goes up. Quantity demanded goes up for the economists. And I've got to fulfill that if I want to hold prices down, you don't. So the theoretical strategy of driving people out of business by cutting prices doesn't work. Now, as I say, I'm not sure how I wanted to say that, because a lot of people believe in that story. McGee, by the way, is the author of the Myth of Predatory Pricing article. But in the case of violence, I mean, part of the problem is that small firms can band together, that existing firms may not want to let the big firms do this, because they could be the next ones to be driven out, and so they can offer alliances. If you end up with the economies of scale are such that a few big firms can outcompete everybody else, then you're finished. Then I don't think the system works very well. But if the economies work out as they have in, I would say, most industries, though by no means all, that the equilibrium gives you many firms, then it seems to me you're likely to be stable. That one of the problems in general perceptions of the economy is that big firms are more valuable, are more visible than small firms. So if you ask people what are the major industries, they tend to focus on industries that have a small number of large firms. And they aren't going to mention something like the restaurant industry, which is, if I'm not mistaken, considerably larger than the steel industry or the auto industry in terms of no total employees and other things of that sort. Other questions? Yeah? that somebody...
You mentioned charity and the role of charity in your idea of of society. And my question to you is, charitable contributions in the last 25 years have decreased although we've seen a rise in per capita income, and yet at the same time this corresponds with arguments for smaller government and anti-government arguments. How does your idea of society take into this account that people seem to be unwilling to donate to charities and this sort of charitable contribution is decreasing, especially among individuals?
Sorry, I don't know the data. Is it decreasing in absolute terms or relative to national income?
In relative terms, in terms of individuals who identify as libertarians or conservatives are less likely to donate to nonprofit organizations. I think this is someone who works for a nonprofit. And
Where is this data? Because I've at least heard the opposite assertion. I have no idea which is true.
The data comes from just a general census of, like...
The what?
The data comes from Idaho, the state of Idaho. If you're a Democrat in the state of Idaho, you're more likely to donate to a nonprofit.
Do you
self-identify as a conservative or libertarian?
Do you know if there's national data on this? Because I've seen precisely the opposite assertion, doubtless made by conservatives.
I think state by state. I don't think there's been a national... in terms of a national organization that's done this. But there has been, especially, I guess, my question, despite that dispute between the U.S. in terms of that idea, but my question would be, in terms of whether there's an economic downturn, there has been a significant decrease in donations.
Sure.
How does your idea of society overcome this role of charity and, the nature of the oscillation in people's giving abilities?
But I'm not arguing whether you will have more or less charity than now. I'm only saying that we do, in fact, observe in most societies that some people are willing to spend money on things they think of as good or for the good of society or for the good of other people, even though they get no monetary response. I assume that in my societies and others, some people will do that. I don't know if there will be more or less than now. You could argue there will be more on the ground that people now can say, well, look, my taxes are taking care of these problems, so why do I have to? I don't know if that's really happened or not. I'm not in that business, obviously. So all I'm saying is that it seems to me you could expect there will be some charitable expenditures. Also, of course, there's sort of a wide range of things. If you think about private solutions to the public good problem, there's a range of things, not all of which we call charity, but that logically are. And my standard example there is tipping a cab driver. That when I tip a cab driver, I'm producing a public good. I'm creating an incentive for cab drivers to do a better job. I'm unlikely to ever see that cab driver again, so I'm not producing a benefit for myself. And yet, very large amounts of money are spent on things like tipping cab drivers. Tipping a waiter in a restaurant you go to regularly, that's not true. There you really have a private incentive to do it, although in a restaurant that you are only occasionally in, you probably don't. So I guess I would simply say that I observe that people have a fairly wide range of incentives. One set of incentives can be modeled pretty well in terms of doing things to make money, but other things people do to get status, they do to feel good about themselves, they do for a variety of other reasons.
My question regards your discussion of national defense. And I heard you say that we don't have strong enemies at the moment. And I would agree, relative to the United States. But isn't that situation part because of the state military that we have? So my question regards to, it seems like the military or the ability for an anarchist society to defend itself is much less organized than a state military. What's to stop the state military from overcoming the military?
I guess that's going to depend on the societies. That I would expect an anarchy on average to be much richer than a state, because it doesn't have the government getting in the way of people doing things all the time, which governments tend to do. So especially if you've managed your anarchy for a while, you ought to be richer. Let me use something some of you might enjoy. There's a science fiction writer by the name of Werner Vinge, and he has a short story called The Ungoverned. And it's a story about the invasion of an anarcho-capitalist area by an adjacent state. And it's quite interesting. It's entertaining. At the end of it, he cites my book as a description of the ideas underlying the anarchist society. And he's assuming the anarchist society is richer. The neat thing in that, it's really not an answer to your question, it's just an interesting observation, are the things that a novelist saw that an economist didn't. Because part of what's going on in that is that the people on each side of the conflict are interpreting the other in their terms. and thus misunderstanding. So that in his plot, in his anarchist society, there are people referred to as armadillos. And an armadillo was someone who didn't like the results of this arbitration system, pulled out, and essentially simply defended himself and didn't have much to do with other people. And in his story, there is a wealthy farmer who is an armadillo. His son lost a case 20 years ago or something. And he has put his resources into turning his farm into a fortress. And when the invasion comes, some teenage boys manage to set up a fake attack from the direction of the farm, with the result that the invasion army heads towards this farm. And what do they discover? There's a fortress in their way. Well, it's perfectly obvious to them that if there's a fortress, it must be part of the defensive system of their enemy. And so they attack the fortress. Well, the farmer is in a richer society than theirs. He's been putting his money for 20 years into fortifying, so they have a fairly hard fight. They can defeat it, of course. This is a whole national army. But it takes quite a while, and they lose a bunch of things. It's really frustrating. It never occurs to them they can just walk around it. All right? At the end of this, when they've destroyed apparently all his defenses, it turns out he has one more defense. He has an atomic bomb. And he has a very deep hole. And he and his family go into a very deep hole, and they set off an atomic bomb above their heads. And it takes out a third of the invading army. And this is, both of these societies are strongly anti-nuclear weapons. This is a future where I think, I don't remember if there's been a nuclear war or not, but for whatever reason, people strongly disapprove of nuclear weapons. And there's a representative of the local rights enforcement agency who is a prisoner of the invading army at this point in their headquarters. And the head of the invading army says, what kind of slime are you using nuclear weapons against us? And the guy looks him in and says, what do you mean us? He's not our customer. And I just thought it was such a beautiful example of the way each side is seeing the world in their pattern rather than the other. But I've now lost, I'm afraid, your original question through my digression, because I thought it was an interesting digression. So, again, repeat.
What's the key to the military?
Yes.
State?
If there is a national state that is as rich as this one and has a strong desire to conquer people, which not all states do, as you may observe, then you could lose. That would be a bad situation to set up an anarchist society. On the other hand, you will observe that one of the disadvantages of having a state is that it gets you into wars that there's no reason to be in, as our state has been doing repeatedly. All right? It ought to have been that after the Soviet Union collapsed, it was over. Right? We had no other enemies of any substantial power. Oddly enough, we managed to find some. All right? So I mean, that's the flip side of it, is that with a government with a national army, it might do a better job of defending you, but it also might do a better job of getting you into trouble.
So I'm not as familiar with your work as other people may be, so I just have a point of clarification. Does your society create a perfectly competitive market?
No, there are no perfectly competitive markets. My society is one which is organized on a basis of private property and trade. And there will be some industries in which the result is 1,000 firms and some which the result is 5 firms and all sorts of things in between. But I regard that as an improvement over a situation where there is one firm, which is the situation we have now with regard to the government. And one firm which is entitled to use legal force to suppress competition. All right, there is a reason why FedEx and UPS don't deliver first-class mail. And it isn't that they can't make money doing it. It's that they would be breaking the law if they did it. Because the private express statute set up in the 19th century gave the post office a monopoly. And they found sufficient loopholes so they could deliver packages. And I think that's true of many, many other things. Other people? He who controls the mic controls the world.
How
if it works.
Like yours, when you prevent against exploitation of humans through capitalist markets.
I don't think capitalist markets exploit humans. That's easy. Or to put it differently, I'm in favor of exploitation. That is to say, I would have said that as a professor, I exploit my students and they exploit me. That is to say, we both benefit by the existence of each other. That's the reason human beings are social animals instead of solitary animals, because we benefit from each other. So maybe you could explain what is the sense. When I say I exploit my students, for example, I teach seminars where hopefully the students learn from me, but I learn from their papers. They write papers on things I don't know that are relevant to my interests. I learn from those. So explain more clearly what you mean and what sense you think capitalism exploits people.
So you see in sweatshops in third world countries where women are forced to do labor for 12 to 15 hours a day, forced to have abortions, they get pregnant because it's not profitable, and are in horrible working conditions and exploited for pennies on the dollar. Yeah.
When you say exploit, you now mean that they're working on less attractive terms than you wish they were. That is to say, what you call a sweatshop is a factory where the pay and conditions are not as good as you would like them to be. And you say that's due to capitalism. And I would say, no, it's due to the fact that those are poor societies, that people don't have high levels of skill. But that's a society. China is a good example, because that's the place you're probably thinking of. And we actually can do the comparison. We know what things were like when it was not a capitalist society. And they were poor, and they were staying poor. They then became a capitalist, but overstated, but a more nearly capitalist society. They shifted from an economy run by the government to an economy a good deal of which was handled by markets and trade. And they have been getting quite rapidly richer since. They're still poor compared to us. They had a long way to go. But they had been stuck because they were ruled by people who claimed capitalism exploited people in a situation where they were not, in fact, getting better. All right, so you know, if you're talking about compelling people to do things, I don't call that exploitation or not, but the people who do the compelling are normally governments. They're the people who have a monopoly over the use of force. If all you mean is the best deal you can get is working 12 hours a day for lower wages than I'd like to work to, well, if that's the best deal you can get, it's better than the alternatives. And saying you can't have that deal, all right, you go back to the farm and you work 14 hours a day and you get even less. Other people? Yeah.
Yeah, this might be a little off topic or something, but so, what's the social responsibility, in your opinion, of a corporation like under capitalism? Are they to look out for the interests of the stockholders or like all stakeholders?
Yeah. I think I would say that it probably makes sense for them to look out for the interest of the stockholders, because the stockholders are the people who are in effect locked in. That is to say, if I am a supplier and I don't like the terms they're offering me, I have the option of selling to someone else or stopping to be a supplier. If I'm an employee and I don't like the terms, I have the option of working for somebody else. If I'm a stockholder, it's true I can sell my stock to someone else. But if they are doing a bad job of maximizing the welfare of stockholders, the guy I sell it to will know that, and therefore I'm going to lose that value of the stock due to their not doing it. So I think on the whole that among the imperfect ways of running an economy, having firms see their obligations subject to, you know, not breaking laws and such as maximizing returns to their stockholders probably works better than any likely alternative. To put it differently, if you say it's a legitimate argument by the president of the company to say, well, it's true I'm not helping my stockholders very much and stock's gone down, but I'm doing wonderful things for the community I'm living in. How do we know? What makes him do that? How do we know that wonderful things doesn't mean I'm buying status for myself by contributing to the opera? Whereas we can see what's happened to the value of the stock. So I think the more complicated you make the supposed obligations of the executives, the more you're in fact leaving them a free hand to pursue their own objectives rather than any of the ones they purportedly are.
So, I was wondering, how do you encourage innovation?
What?
How do you encourage innovation?
How do I encourage?
Innovation in a place that are...
By not making laws against it.
No, I mean, this is actually a really close point to me, because I'm from Kenya.
From Canada?
Kenya.
Kenya?
From Kenya.
Kenya, not Canada. Right, different place.
Yeah, anyway, the reason I was asking this is because
in Kenya we don't have a very efficient enforcement of intellectual property rights. So it's really hard for you to find innovators out there, you know, who are willing to take their products public and stuff like that. So I was just wondering.
But I would say that in general, what encourages innovations is having private property rights, having relatively little regulation, because what tends to happen in regulation is the people who are already the ins are the ones who have the political influence, and they naturally, being sensible people, use that influence to try to suppress new competitors who are doing things differently. So it seems to me that I know nothing about Kenya, so I can't really offer opinions about that. But I think that in general, what you want is a society where people are free to do stuff, to exchange with each other, without having to bribe a politician, or get some regulator to give them permission. I'm trying to remember the name. I'm terrible on names, but there's an ex-colleague of mine who's fairly prominent in the sort of, intellectual commons world. Larry Lessig, that's who it is. And he wrote a book in which he was arguing that you wanted to have the internet function as what he called a commons, though it really wasn't a commons, but a system where you and I can use the internet for what we like and the people in between us don't get to regulate it. And his basic argument was that that made innovation easier, because otherwise anytime I have a new idea, I've got to get permission from a bunch of middlemen in order to do anything. And it didn't occur to him that he'd also just written an argument against zoning. Because, of course, zoning regulation is the same issue, that when you do something, rather with your property or on the internet, you sometimes impose costs on other people, and therefore there is some reason to require their permission. On the other hand, if you set up legal rules where doing anything requires everybody to agree, nothing gets done. And therefore, just as zoning rules, which say if I'm using my land in a way you disapprove of, you get the zoning commission to forbid me to do it, like rules which say if you're doing things on the internet which I think are putting too much traffic on my fiber optic lines that are carrying messages and therefore I won't let you do it, any of those make innovation harder. So I guess you want as nearly as possible a society in which people can do things without needing a lot of permission from other people, and then you're likely to get more new things done. Other people? Yeah.
The rights firms, this is similar to the first question. Wouldn't that encourage tiered services like you see with internet providers or even high-tech lawyers?
Yeah, just like we have now. That is to say, if you think that you in fact get the same outcome from the court, whether or not you can afford a lawyer, you are misleading yourself. And whether or not you can afford a good lawyer. So yes, no, I think it's very likely, probably not in terms of rights. I may be wrong, but my guess is it's going to be easier to have one legal system to have a court and a legal system that you go to. But the question of how fast the cops show up when you call them, I could certainly imagine that if you buy their diamond service, they install that automatic camera I mentioned, and they've got somebody who's randomly monitoring those cameras, and sometimes they see someone break in and do something. If you get their base level service, well, if somebody robs you, when they find out who did it, they'll do something about it, but that's not high priority, right? So no, I think that's quite likely. But of course, it's true in our present society. And it's true of lots of other things that, you know, you get better food if you can afford a really good restaurant than if you go to a McDonald's. That's part of the point of trying to have money in order to be able to get better things.
All right, this is going to be the last question.
All right. They're going to drive us out? All right.
I feel privileged. That's the last question. All right, so you seem to be an academic in the purest sense, which I really respect. You don't assert anything more than you can reason with, but that's very clear. So here's my challenge. Can you reasonably assert that underprivileged people in society, those who are mentally or physically disabled or just uneducated or poor because of their status and other work, that those people will be better off under the system you propose than under the system?
Yeah, I think so. That if you ask at present what are the areas in which poor people are most disadvantaged in our society, it's not in their access to food. It's true that grocery stores are a bit more expensive in low-income areas and the quality isn't as good. It's in their access to police protection and education, two of the major services produced by government. So I think if you actually look at it, that one of the virtues of the market is you get to decide what's important to you. That most poor people don't have zero. They have less than richer people. And being sensible like everybody else, they spend what they have on what matters to them. My guess is that in a world where by spending a little more you get better police protection, a lot of poor people would have better police protection because it would save them more than it would cost them. Ditto for schooling. In a world where the only way to get better police protection is to move to a high-income suburb, that's a rather expensive project if you live in Watts or Harlem or South Side of Chicago. So I guess my answer is that it seems to me that contrary to what it pretends, governments do not in general help or benefit the weak and the powerless. They benefit different people. Different, you know, political power becomes more important. Financial power is still very useful in getting governments to do things, but political power also matters. But, you know, if you're sufficiently powerless, you've really got a problem in any society, because the only person you can really trust to take care of your interests is yourself, and you don't have much in that situation. All right. Thanks to those who stayed through all of this. I hope you enjoyed it.